Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between personal health and our total health environment, the health of our food, water, society, culture, belief system, all the different things that affect our health, the health of our communities, the health of our society, and the health of our habitat, planet Earth. I'm delighted to bring you a series of terrific guests who are working on all different facets of this multifaceted universe we live in to try to bring and restore and protect our health in a whole range of different ways. One of the things that I hear a lot as someone who has been in the media for more decades than I care to count, and most recently blogging on the Huffington Post, where you can follow me, Allison Rose Levy, and you can also read my blogs on my personal blog site, healthjournalistblog.com. One of the things that people say to me all the time is, how come this isn't being covered? This should be covered. Why isn't the media covering this? We have a bit of a blank spot when it comes to the media, because on the one hand, we all know the media is commercialized, subject to influence, and actually some people don't know, but it's really been in decline over the last 20 years or so. I regard myself as a sort of a survivalist in coming along in the media at a time when, for political reasons and business reasons and reasons of impaired social values, it has really been taken down. And there's been, you know, progressively with the decline of newspapers and even the onset of the Internet, which connects us all across the world and brings to the fore a whole bunch of terrific citizen journalists, there's something that's really being filled in and served by that, and there are other things that are missing because there are tough stories, detailed stories, stories that entail a lot of digging and a lot of research, or that require a lot of editorial backup and support to tell, that are told less often, and so there's been a kind of dumbing down, and a lot of the same information gets recycled, and a lot of information gets completely left out. So I'm always educating people to this a little, as I am here at the beginning of the show today, because it's important to understand the context for all information. There's been a rise of spending and investment and peopling of PR and a decline in the spending, the funding, and the business and coverage of journalism. And this is a blow to democracy, to a well-informed populace, and to really helping people be aware of the kinds of issues of which they need to be aware. So I know in terms of listeners to Connect the Dots, I'm kind of speaking to the choir a little bit today, but in effect what we try to do on this show and what is happening throughout the Progressive Radio Network is we're kind of putting Humpty Dumpty back together again and showing you all the diverse pieces of the puzzle and things that come together to create our health. Now, that I know can sometimes feel a little overwhelming. What can I do about this? What should I do about that? Wow, it's terrible they're doing this. What can one little person do about that? And we also have to live in a society that's doing all these things and keep doing the tasks of our everyday lives to sustain ourselves, not to mention our communities, the society, and the earth. So, you know, I provide this information and welcome all these guests, not to overwhelm you, even though I understand that it sometimes is overwhelming, but really so that you can work on the pieces that you can work on, do what you can do, find easy ways to plug in and participate in some other stuff, and just be all around well informed about the issues before they make it onto the front pages or even the back pages. You can be ahead of the curve. So I'm so thankful to all of you who listen. And if you need to contact me, Please do. I'd love to hear from you. You can write to me, care of my website, healthjournalistblog.com, or follow me on Twitter or on Facebook, where my page is Connecting the Dots for Health. Now, on today's show, I'm delighted to say that I have two guests who will be joining me, first one and then the other, and in important conversations about how to protect our health and our food. In the first half of the show, I'll be speaking with Barbara Arundel, a co-founder and director of Damascus Citizens for Sustainable Energy, one of the very first fractivist organizations in the Northeast region, and one of the best informed people on a whole range of topics connected to sustainable energy, fracking, its dangers, its risks, and, you know, and what the alternatives are available to us if we can muster the social will to move our politicians and policymakers down the road to more sustainable energy. So we'll first be talking with Barbara, and then in the second part of the show, I'll be joined by Nancy Romer, director of the Brooklyn Food Coalition, which recently hosted a fabulous conference. So you're going to be hearing about some little-known risk factors of fracking in the earlier part of the show, and then we'll go on and talk about all of the lessons learned about how we need to have a just, fair, and healthy food supply in the second part of the show. So now I'd like to welcome Barbara Arundel. This is Barbara, this is your second appearance with us. So delighted to have you here.
Thank you very much. I'm equally delighted to be here.
Damascus Citizens is really an extraordinary organization. I just want to say a little bit about it and also point listeners to the website. This is Damascus Citizens has been working on the fracking issue, I think it's safe to say, certainly longer than any other grassroots group in the Northeast region, and there are many wonderful groups, and we've had many of the leaders on Connect the Dots, and we'll continue to do so. But you've been at work at it for longer than anyone else, and that really actually also makes you one of the longest live fractivist organizations in the entire country. And I really recommend that people go to the website for Damascus Citizens, which is simply Damascus, D-A-M-A-S-C-U-S, citizens.org, because there's just a wealth of information about every single aspect of how fracking touches our lives. And fracking, for those who are listening to the show for the first time and unaware of it, is a process of getting gas out of the ground. It's actually from shale, so it's called, I call it shale gas, even though the PR firms for the gas industry calls it natural gas, you know, but I mean every substance on earth is natural, so this is actually, the correct name would be shale gas. It comes out of shale deep, which lies embedded in rock, and because of a new process called horizontal fracking, horizontal hydraulic slick water fracturing, it actually uses an enormous range of toxic chemicals as well as releasing dangerous underground substances, which is what we're going to be talking about on today's show, and therefore has a whole range of health risks, risks to our habitat, water, air, food, land, as well as, you know, the ensuing health and economic problems that come from that. So, you know, in different shows we treat different aspects. Today we're going to be kind of zeroing right in on something, a really breaking story on this topic that you, Barbara, and Damascus Citizens have been leading the charge on, which is a direct risk factor of fracking in the Northeast region, and specifically coming into, poised to come into New York State, but so far hovering and not yet coming in, so that's a good chance still for people to take action. And that is a very something that really people have not identified until now as a risk factor, but which you have identified, and this is a breaking news story, and that is the presence of radon in the natural gas, and that comes from the shale. So radon, for people who are not aware of it, is a highly carcinogenic substance. If you ever buy a property, for example, you can't pass inspection without going through a radon check. If you buy a house anywhere, you have to check the radon levels, because if they are dangerous, this is a deal breaker on a house purchase, and unless they are addressed, radon is so toxic and dangerous and carcinogenic, and it comes up out of the earth. And so, Barbara, what you and Damascus have been finding out is that radon actually comes into the shale gas, and this shale gas is intended to be, sent anywhere it's needed, but more directly and more intensively down into New York City to heat apartment buildings and homes and residences there. So the radon that people have to make sure they get rid of, or address in some manner, if it's coming into their home when they purchase a house that sits on the ground, is now going to be getting into, like, the express track to come running down to New York City to many residential and other buildings there. So this is, no one has spoken of this yet. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about that?
Okay, well, there's several factors. First of all, a major portion of the gas, of course, is used in heating, and natural gas was first differentiated from coal gas. That's where the word natural comes from. But the Marcellus Shale is highly radioactive, and that's how people drilling for gas actually find the layer, is by its radioactivity. That radioactivity is from radium. Radium decays to radon. All radioactive materials are highly active, and they move from one elemental structure to another, and they give off energy when they do. And radon is a gas, and it moves with the gas that goes into the pipeline and goes not just to heating facilities, but also to your kitchen stove. And even somebody who says, well, I don't cook. Well, you have a pilot light, and it's continuously giving off radon because the radon is not burned. Methane burns some of the mixture that is natural gas. Almost all of them do burn, except for the radon. Radon does not burn. And
so,
it's also
heavy. So, Barbara,
heavy.
let me say here. So if I'm down in the city and this shale gas with the radon is being rushed down to the city, then I make a pot of tea, I boil some water in the morning, I turn on the gas, and you're saying that right now there's not a lot of radioactivity or a lot of radon that comes out of that gas. But if we allow this shale gas to be harvested, there's going to be radioactivity coming out of my stove when I turn on the kettle? Is that
what
you're saying?
Well, even now there is. But it's, most of the gas comes from the western areas of the United States, and it spends a long time in transit. Mm-hmm. What's called the half-life of this radon is 3.8 days. So in the time it takes, about six days, to get to New York, it's much lower, because each time it goes down by half. But first of all, from Pennsylvania, where there's a lot of gas, and by the way, it all goes into the pipeline. It's being mixed now, and nobody's measuring. Nobody's looking at this. Nobody's measuring what the radon levels and radioactivity levels are in the gas mixture that arrives in New York City now. But if they
no one's measuring.
Nobody's measuring, no.
People are
Sane Energy Project, which is a wonderful grassroots organization in New York City, has distributed radioactivity little meters. They're little stationary things, and you just put them in your kitchen, and then after a period of time, you send them back, and they're analyzed. But nobody's looking at this, and the pipeline that's proposed for New York City is to facilitate a huge amount of gas coming from Pennsylvania, which is very close, with a matter of hours in the pipeline. So the decay is going to be very little from the source to New York City. This is the Spectra pipeline that's proposed and being rushed through by the city government, with nobody looking, nobody having hearings, nobody doing anything. So, except that there's been thousands of negative comments about it, which are now being ignored. And when this gas arrives in people's kitchens, it could be anywhere from 125 times the level that is today to much higher, and nobody's looking.
And why would the levels be higher? Because it's rushed down here so quickly? That's one reason. Is there another reason why that would be higher than usual?
One is the closeness, and the other is that the Marcellus Shale is the most highly radioactive shale layer that has gas in it of any that's been measured. It's very high in radioactivity, as I mentioned before. That's one of the ways they find it, is by radioactivity measurements all the way up from the surface.
Wow. So, you know, is it a matter of they should just, I mean, what if they just held it in one place? Then they're kind of saying, oh, it's going to decay here in this big pot.
Well, that
is
one thing.
Poison everybody, you know, that's in the place where I'm holding it. Are they spending billions of dollars to create a delay loop, and how long would they need to hold it? Or is any of this not being even asked?
Well, yes. None of it's being asked. However, that is one way that the radioactivity could be mitigated, as it's called, before it arrives at the end user, which is your kitchen or your dryer or your heating facility. But that's not being done. And then also the holding facility would result in getting a lot of radioactivity. And what happens when this material decays is also very interesting. It goes from being a gas to two solid elements, polonium and a form of lead. That's both of those are radioactive at that instant. And what the radioactivity means is that it's highly active. It gives off a lot of energy. That's why radon is so dangerous and causes lung cancer, is because it decays quickly. It lets loose this energy into your body, which makes your cells sort of very sick. And that release of energy is a cause of lung cancer that's as much as that's second to actual smoking, is second is radon from people living in areas where there is radon. And if you increase this amount of radon into people's homes in New York City, the best look at this point says there's going to be somewhere around 30,000 additional deaths from lung cancer, and who knows who that will be. Plus, children are most sensitive to it, and this is a heavier material than air. It goes down to the floor. So if you have short people, kids, that are down lower, they're going to get a better dose of this than taller folks.
Oh, my God, that is just terrible. Well, you know, thank you so much, Barbara. And, you know, I want to do two things now, because we're going to, you know, kind of go for citizen identification in a minute or so right here. But one is I want to make sure that you'll come back on our show and help track this unfolding story with us here on Connect the Dots. And, you know, because this is a new story, it's a new breaking consideration, something to stay on top of. Also, I want to help our listeners, anyone who would like to track this, stay on top of the issue, participate in any upcoming actions to investigate this before we just run wholesale into it. They should go to DamascusCitizens.org, your website, and they can sign up there for an email. Can they follow you on Twitter? What is your Twitter handle?
Oh, yes. We are, actually, I don't know, but we are on Twitter and Facebook. And any group or organization that is concerned about this, or individuals, can email dcs@DamascusCitizens.org and put radon in the subject, and we'll get right back to you about what you can do.
Oh, thank you. So that's great for listeners. So anybody, if you're personally concerned, or if you're with an organization or a group that might be concerned about this, like realtors, holding companies, food, health organizations, please do write to that email. Thank you so much, Barbara Arundel, and we look forward to having you back next time to keep filling us in on this evolving issue.
Okay. Happy. Thank you.
Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. And in this half of the show, I'll be talking with Nancy Romer. She's the general coordinator of the Brooklyn Food Coalition, which is one of the largest, I think it is the largest, grassroots food organization in New York City. And Brooklyn is actually the equivalent size to a major American city, and I think is in the top five. So this is a major undertaking, and the coalition recently sponsored the second Brooklyn Food Conference, which was a huge success. Nancy is joining me on Connect the Dots today to talk about the lessons learned from this extraordinary event. And, I was delighted to participate in the food conference, both moderating two panels, one on GMOs and one on food, how fracking gets into the food supply, as well as working on the programming committee. So let's welcome Nancy Romer, general coordinator and really co-founder of the Brooklyn Food Conference. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Nancy.
Thank you very much for having me.
So glad to have you here. Now, how many people actually wound up attending? Because this was a mass event, and so many people going to so many programs. Just give our listeners a bit of an overview about who attended and what was offered and how many people you got and all of that.
Well, we had about 5,000 people there, which mm-hmm. was wonderful. We were happy to have a large crowd, but we were even more happy to have a very diverse crowd. So many people came up to us and said they'd never been in an event like this where the diversity on every level except geographic was so amazing. We had old people and babies and kids and teens. We had black people and white people and Latino folks and Asian American folks. That felt really great. We did a lot of outreach. We've been doing a lot of work in communities of color, and we were so happy to see that reflected in the people who came to the conference. So there was a wonderful mix, and that's really what we feel most strongly about. That's what we feel the food movement needs to be about, is everybody pulling together.
Yeah, and I think that's an excellent awareness, Nancy. And it's not something that I mean, I come out of health reporting, and you know, there are recommendations: eat this, don't eat that. I mean, I also report a lot on the environment, and am very much in the world of ecology and green. And often, for example, I'll hear people say, "Well, you know, everyone should just go live in the country and plant their own backyard garden, and that is the best possible response we could have to any problems with the systemic food supply." And you know, there's just a kind of well-intentioned but naive ignorance, we're forgetting that people of all different places, of all different economic statuses, in all different life situations need access to food and to healthy food. And it's not just, you know, not everybody has the capacity to, you know, go and acquire a tract of land and grow it for themselves, even though there is a lot more now being done with growing foods in urban areas. So I think what you're mentioning about the inclusiveness and the diversity of having a wide range of people in the food conversation is so, so important.
Well, I think the way we frame it, and I think this is not just Brooklyn Food Coalition, but I think this is the way the food movement in general is framing itself, is mm-hmm. that it's stands on three legs, what we call our three pillars, and that is healthy, affordable food for all, sustainable food systems, and justice for food workers. So when you include those three pillars into your definition of the food movement, then it brings a much wider range of people. And I think the main purpose of the Brooklyn Food Conference, and of course of the Brooklyn Food Coalition as well on a more ongoing basis, is to bring those groups together so that we're not just looking at how do we get healthy food to people, but we're also looking at how do we get sustainable agriculture to bring that healthy food to people, because we're not going to get healthy food, we're not going to get healthy people unless we have sustainable agriculture, and we also have to have a sense of fairness and equity so that our the people that bring us the food, that pick the crops, that process the food, that work in the retail and that work in the restaurants can actually afford to eat the food that they provide for us. So I think it's a very broad politic that is sort of automatically inclusive. You know, as you say in your show, connect the dots. So that's exactly what we're trying to do, is connect those big dots and create a movement that is going to be powerful and conscious, not just I want mine, but I want ours. I want to make sure that we all have something that is sustainable and can bring equity.
Yeah, sustainable, I really love the sense of broadening what is meant by sustainable. Sustainable means, you know, has come into use through the environmental movement, and it means, you know, recycling or using or conserving, or making the most of the assets here on Earth, you know, so that they can continue to provide abundantly for the needs of people, and that's the original meaning. But sustainable also has an economic meaning, it has a human meaning, and so what, you know, you've actually taken the term and amplified it to its full extension, you know.
Because if we don't include
those dimensions, then, you know, so when people say, oh, well, I'm not an environmentalist, so I don't care about sustainable, it's kind of like we all care about it because it encompasses all of that.
Yeah, and so for us, we will participate in the struggle for a living wage, for example, because living wage means that it's not only food workers that get a living wage, but it also means that people can afford to buy food.
Right.
And it's only when your people can buy food and buy healthy food that it then also sustains the farmers who are growing using healthier methods. And it keeps going around like that. So we want to make sure that, we're very much the 99%. You know, we very much identify with that kind of thinking. We want to make sure that there's enough distribution of resources so that people can live decently.
Yes, it is all very integral and integrated in a sense, integrating all these different dimensions. And so part of that also comes to public policy, which I know that your organization is also very active on, which means that, you know, yes, if I am one with the wherewithal to buy, you know, the $5 organic tomato from California, and maybe, you know, not think about that others can't get a tomato, or, you know, what all the costs are to the environment of flying that tomato in. And I'm not trying to guilt trip people for, you know, eating that tomato, but it's really, you know, it is the way that our public dollars as taxpayers are spent that shapes the whole framework in which food is either subsidized and made more widely available, or lacks support and structure for foods that may be healthier and in the long run cost the whole society less in terms of health problems, in terms of a whole host of other things. But we're not necessarily supporting the structures that sustain healthy farms as much as we maybe do the growing of crops that now make cheap food that make people sick, you know. So this comes down to what choices do we as citizens make in terms of how our society spends our tax dollars
to create a healthy food supply. Are we doing that? Are we stepping up to make sure that happens? Could you talk a little bit about that aspect of it for our listeners?
Well, one of the themes of the conference definitely was the upcoming U.S. Farm Bill. And that Farm Bill is a very important document in terms of framing what the food system is going to look like for the next 5 years. It's one of these omnibus bills that has a five-year cycle. So every 5 years, we get a chance to reshape the food system. Mm-hmm. And it has historically, in the last maybe 25, 30 years, been pouring subsidies to agribusiness to produce the crops we need the least, but that and are making us the fattest and the thickest and are feeding the cheap supply of meat. Mm-hmm. So that's corn, rice, soy, and wheat. And a lot of that ends up animal feed. So an animal feed that is, again, unhealthy, and because the animals are sick, they're given prophylactic antibiotics, they're given growth hormones so that they can fatten up fast, and that ends up in people's bodies, and we have all sorts of problems. We also, a lot of that, those crops are also genetically engineered, and we have not had adequate research to show what the effects of that genetically food can be on our people. We certainly know that high fructose corn syrup, which is one of the products that comes out of all that corn supply, is very unhealthy for us. So the Farm Bill covers a lot of different areas, but the three big ones that we're focusing on are subsidies to agribusiness, conservation measures, and food stamps or SNAP benefits. We, of course, very much want to see conservation measures increased. They will. Everything's being cut right now because everything is serving this insane idea that we should not have a debt. No, nobody wants a debt, but when you're in an economic crisis, you don't work on the debt. You work on getting people back to work so that you can increase your tax base. But the Republicans seem to be very focused on the debt, so which is a great ploy for how to shovel more money to the top. They're not satisfied with this imbalance in wealth, but they want to keep it going in that direction. So conservation should be increased, and food stamps should also be increased. The reason that we need more food stamps is that that money goes right into the local economies. That money can buy the food from the local farmer and can improve health outcomes dramatically. So conservation and food stamps are two features of the Farm Bill that can both improve the economy, but also can improve the health of the land and the health of the people. So we'd like to see a dramatic decline in the subsidies to agribusiness, producing crops that we don't need, and an increase in support for a specialty, what they call specialty crops. I mean, this is how insane it is. They call fruits and vegetables our specialty crops. it's insane. Like you're thinking, special form of arugula. It's really all the fruits and vegetables are under specialty crops. Just the language of it is so interesting.
Oh, gosh.
But it's language that obfuscates what's going on. And what we want to be able to do, and one of the things that I think that the Brooklyn Food Conference was able to do, is to speak to people very directly and plainly about why folks in the city should care about the Farm Bill and why subsidies to agribusiness are actually dangerous and why support for what they're calling specialty crops is important and why conservation measures are a long-term investment for our food and land for the future. Mm-hmm. And then also to be able to create alliances with farmers, especially in a place like New York State or the New York metropolitan region, to be able to see that we need, while city folks need to support conservation and specialty crop measures, the farmers need to be able to support food stamps because food stamps are going to be enabling people to buy their food from those farmers. Mm-hmm. Also, an interesting thing about food stamps is that money circulates within the neighborhoods. It's spent in the neighborhoods, and it circulates in the neighborhood. So we that $1 of food stamps has a $1.84 value in the neighborhood, because it keeps bouncing around from store to, from storekeeper to store worker, and around and around. So it feeds our communities more than once.
That's fascinating, because, you know, this is such a wonderful reframing, because, you know, food stamps have kind of been like denigrated as you know, a drain on the economics of our country or community, where in fact what you're saying is characterizing you know, foods, real foods like vegetables, as a specialty crop in order to favor and produce weird synthetic foods that are cheap and ersatz and make people sick. That's actually a big drain, and in fact, and a big drain on both the economy, the quality of our food, and our health. And in fact, food stamps are the it's kind of like being given money on the Monopoly board, which you then spend. So that's actually the root of supporting businesses, supporting communities, getting to healthy food so your own health can be better. It's kind of like giving local needs and local currency, really, and in fact feeding things, so that more can grow and develop of the things that we need, the food, the local economy, the health of the people in a community. So, you know, thank you so much for that reframing. I think it's so important for people to understand that, because, you know, I began the show talking a bit about the shift from journalism to PR in programming, how we think about and view all of these different things. And so there's been a big negative PR dumped on food stamps. And right. You're pointing out that they have not only real benefit, but they're vital.
Well, another way to frame it is that the commodity crops are Wall Street,
yeah,
and food stamps are Main Street. Because
totally.
That money is circulating, but also the zip code that receives the largest subsidies from the Farm Bill is the Upper East Side of Manhattan.
What? Can you say that again?
Yeah.
You have to repeat that again, because that is such a mind bender. Uh-huh.
The zip code that receives the largest number of commodity checks is the Upper East Side. Because it doesn't go to real farmers. It goes to corporate owners of farms.
Wow.
So the way that the Farm Bill is talked about, you imagine this, you know, the silo and the farmer and the tractor and, you know, the piece of hay coming out of the farmer's mouth. But that's not what's happening. These are corporate farms that, and they're factory farms that are getting the subsidies. And the owners wouldn't be caught dead living on those farms.
Mm.
They're, you know, the corporate owners are living on the Upper East Side of Manhattan and going to fancy dinners. So, it's a very, you know, so when we talk about food stamps, we have to remember that it's a stimulus program. It's an economic stimulus program to Main Street.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So, in other words, that is just amazing. That's an amazing, that is an absolute shock that most of those commodity checks go to the Upper East Side. I don't know what researcher dug that one out, but that was a brilliant piece of investigation. To find that, you know, and I just want to add also, this has real, all that we're talking about, as you mentioned, has real health costs. So when people at all levels of society are eating healthy food, and it's not just kind of an elite thing that fewer and fewer and fewer people are able to access or afford, really that gives a big boost to the overall health of the society, and our health expenses have been growing astronomically. And we, you know, actually have some of the poorest measures for health outcomes. We're far below any other developed nation. We're down there with Bulgaria, in terms of our health measures, which are, you know, longevity, child mortality, all of that. And, you know, all of these things affect children, all the health risks that we allow affect children and the health of the next generation, so that, you know, children from earlier in life are having all kinds of illnesses due to toxicity in the environment, as well as toxic foods creating obesity. So all of that has a cost as people move through the lifespan. It has a cost to them, and it has a cost to society, A, because they're, instead of being highly functional participants, they're needing a lot of health supports, and B, it has an economic cost, and having a higher proportion of people who are below par due to health is a drain upon it makes the well functioning or better functioning members of society have to really pedal harder to keep things going. And so this is part of an overall pattern on a society-wide level that's really draining the resources, both energetic, functional, economic, and other, whereas if you seed it from the bottom and help everyone become more healthy, it has a huge impact in a whole diverse bunch of areas. And the biggest thing is really also just in terms of human caring, valuing healthy food, getting healthy, nourishing food to people is so critical.
Well, you know, it's very interesting because those features are called externalities in economics. You know, what are the externalities? That is the external costs that are not brought into the equation when people are producing goods and selling them. And for us, it's really the health and environmental costs. I was very fortunate to be able to go to the White House with a Michelle Obama event. I wasn't invited, but somebody else was invited who then couldn't make it, and I substituted for her. But anyway, I want to be honest about that. I was not the invitee originally. But it was about she was launching her Let's Move campaign on childhood obesity. Mm-hmm. And Peter Orszag, who was at the time the head of the Office of Management and the Budget, spoke. And he said that it costs the public purse $1,500 a year more per person who is obese than who has normal weight. And he said that it is a higher risk than smoking. So that's a very important fact to take in.
Mm-hmm.
Preventive medicine, which, of course, we don't practice in this country, which is one of the reasons that we have such bad health stats, would have us eating healthier food, would be cleaning up the environment so there would be fewer toxins, and we would be paying a little bit more up front and much, much less for these externalities, much less in the future for health, serious health and environmental code. But we are not looking down the long road. We're looking at the immediate short term and coming up with ridiculous solutions. So, and I think that the American people, I think the poor education that we've had in this country, the underfunding and the very inadequate education, despite the valiant attempts of so many teachers to provide good educational services, I think we have a nation of people who are not aware of either economics or science, those two big factors or big areas of study. Many Americans are very unaware and poorly educated on those issues. So they don't understand that what we don't pay for now, we end up paying for later. Mm-hmm. So I think that those externalities are tremendously important to be aware of. And, you know, those issues, you sort of bring it back to the Brooklyn Food Coalition and to the Brooklyn Food Conference. We had 175 workshops that covered almost all of those topics, you know, from various points of view. So people could dig in and be part of the projects on the ground that are really important for creating knowledge, creating community, and creating change, like the farmers markets, like the CSAs, like the food co-ops, like the school food committees that are demanding and creating changes for what kids are eating in their schools. we have a lot of that action going on, the environmental action groups that are working on fracking, the union and labor organizing committees that are working on improving working conditions and the wages of workers in the food industry. So these are all the parts that need to be strengthened, but we need to be able to take those strengthened parts and push for both policy change that comes through our elected officials. And if our elected officials are not carrying the water for us, we need to get new elected officials. They need to hear us roar and respond. Mm-hmm. And we also need to be part of the broader social movements that participate in nonviolent direct action, whether it's demonstrations or letter-writing campaigns or Occupy or whatever that might be. I think we need to be very clear and link arms with the environmental movement, with the health movement, with the anti-racist movement, the women's movement. These are our allies with the labor movement. These are our allies, and we need to keep each other aware and educated, and we need to be able to act together to see the kind of change that our people need.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I think Nancy, that is what you're articulating there is a vision for how it can work. That we create a healthier and better society by linking arms on all these issues. And that doesn't mean that, you know, we won't concentrate. Individuals are not, you know, infinite in and of themselves as individuals, but we can be infinite by linking arms and being in a larger group, which means that, you know, one can work, each one of us can work on, you know, the one or more target issues that are really of passionate, immediate importance to us, but we can also understand and stand in relationship and participate, you know, maybe not on so frequent a basis in other larger concerns and know when it's important to stand up for, you know, for an overarching concern. Like getting money out of politics or dealing with climate change, you know, that kind of affects everyone, even if that's not the thing that you track every, you know, every week or every month, you know. And I think you're right. That is the way to do it. There has to be. And yet disappointing, like I loved when you said, you know, if we, for example, in who are healthy foodies, and I count myself among them and written health books and all of that, you know, and eating healthy. If we in urban communities that want to eat healthy foods don't look beyond our local community supplier to the farmers and the policies that support our healthy farmers and our healthy local farmers and artisan providers and growers and help sustain them, then it won't be coming home to our plate. And at the same time, to educate those out in the farms who are, for, you know, for whom we're seeking to support and protect and develop what they're doing, they also can be educated about food stamps, maybe, which is something that might be might not be so concentrated in their regions, that they might not understand is an ally issue. And
right.
You know, for example, in the health community, you know, there's always been this make personal health choices, and I think a lot of the people that are a lot of the grassroots of the health community, people that have been educated by, you know, all of the well-known integrative physicians as well as people like me to make healthy choices, I think those are the ground troops in a lot of these movements. But, you know, for example, I got an email from some health leadership folks a couple months back basically saying, you know, support Ron Paul, and you know, I don't get really into politics on the show, but because, you know, he'll permit us to have, he's interested in a health freedom stance in terms of, you know, allow people to make the choice of the practitioner they wish to see rather than have the government dictate, you know, only conventional medicine is applicable. And that was their rationale of some people for supporting Ron Paul. And I understand the health freedom need and the health freedom argument, but if you just stand on a single plank of a spectrum of issues in that place, you know, you could be undermining, really the mass population that really is standing together by divisiveness or by making a divisive stance around a given issue. It's better, from my standpoint, if we educate everyone to the need on one hand for some baseline health care coverage, you know, that is needed by the population, and we also educate to health freedom, which is the choice that, you know, have people having freedom of choice to access integrative care, then we are to just vote for one and then split off from the, you know, the whole widespread group of you know, that should be holding hands in the way that you envision.
Well, I want to give an example of that. I totally agree with you, Allison. But the CEO of Whole Foods wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times during the healthcare debate, saying that he was against any kind of healthcare because healthcare insurance, because he felt people should be eating healthy food, and if they eat healthy food, they wouldn't need healthcare. And it's just so absurd.
Yeah.
To think that all, that food alone is going to make you or break you in terms of health. If you, I know a lot of people who are struggling with cancer now who eat very healthy, and they couldn't be eating healthier, frankly. But they're still struggling with cancer. Now you can't say, well, too bad, you know, just eat your greens. That's not going to do it. We have to have a much more sophisticated and inclusive way of looking at things. There are people that cannot afford health care, and they will die simply if they're not given health care. So I think we have to be very aware of that. And we also have to be able to, I think, just in terms of the local scene, in terms of city and state, because you did say something about the U.S. Farm Bill that's in the Congress right now. People should write to their senators and their Congress members saying that they want to have more support for conservation measures and for food stamps and for specialty crops and not for commodity crops. But we would love
to. Can I just interject here for a second, Nancy? Is there a link on the Brooklyn Food Coalition website where people can easily write, or if not, is there an ally organization where they could go online and, you know, kind of readily get the wording and who to write to and all of that kind of thing? Is there any action posted, or will you be posting such an action
so that they sign up for you? We will be. And our website is brooklynfoodcoalition.org. And through that website, you can link to the conference site and see what we did there. And that's a very, very vibrant site, the conference site. We don't have that link up now for the Farm Bill. We should, but we were very overwhelmed with the conference.
Sure.
I would suggest people go to Food and Water Watch. Just Google in Food and Water Watch, and they'll come up. And they have direct links to members of Congress and information on the Farm Bill there. We have a policy committee that works closely with Food and Water Watch. And by the way, they were one of the sponsors of our conference, which was wonderful that they were that. But I just want to also mention that we'd like to see city and state government produce legislation that would require the steady increase of the percentage of food that is sourced and procured for New York City produced meals and New York State produced meals, that is the meals that the government produces, to be more and more locally sourced, to require the local sourcing of a greater percentage of food each successive year until we get to almost 100%. And that is, just to know that New York City alone prepares 1 million meals a day, 860,000 of which are school meals, but they also serve meals to seniors and to some of the local jails, to some city hospitals. The state serves meals to hospitals, prisons, universities. They serve a lot of food.
So we're really in a position to create. We're coming into the last moments of the show here. We're in the position in New York to actually create a revisioned food system because of these numbers, and which can serve as a model for how to do that on other levels. You know, we're obviously going to have you back again, Nancy Rover, here at Connect the Dots. It's been fantastic talking to you. There's a lot more to be discussed. And, you know, I'm going to totally invite you back because, you know, be a regular part of this conversation. This has been wonderful. And thank you so much for all the work you're doing. And I really urge, you know, everyone listening to the show to go to brooklynfoodcoalition.com and you can sign up.
.org.
Okay, .org. Yeah, because I'm looking here. It says ning.com. You know, and please sign up for the email to be informed. Follow them on Facebook and Twitter where they post all kinds of interesting things that you might want to be informed about. Thank you so much, Nancy.
Thank you, Alison. You have a great show, and I'm honored to be on it.
Well, you'll come on again. And thank you, listeners. Please stay tuned next week for Connect the Dots at 10 a.m. Eastern Time every week, Wednesdays on the Progressive Radio Network. Thank you.